This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Toppled trees litter medians, snap power lines, and line residential streets now a week after Hurricane Irma roared through. Later in the show, we'll talk with a certified arborist about which trees can be saved, which ones will survive wet roots, and what you should choose to replace those that fell. But first, some people in Collier County are spending another day without power, and more are dealing with the smell of sewage that isn't being moved out and away from their neighborhoods like usual. The problem is the pump stations have no power or were damaged by being submerged in floodwater. Here to tell us how the county is doing in trying to fix them all is Margie Hapke with Collier County Public Utilities. Margie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Julie.
We are talking about the wastewater situation and all of the water woes after Hurricane Irma. Do you have a question? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Margie, I talked with you last Friday, and now a few days have passed. Are we any closer to having all these pumps operational?
Yes, ma'am, we are. We are turning the corner on recovering the wastewater system. Out of, I think I told you on Friday that we have more than 800 of these pump stations throughout the county. As of this morning, we're down to just 160 that still do not have electrical power. But we do have crews out there 24/7 using generators and pumper trucks to maintain the flows at those stations.
Trying to keep it going. So 160 are still not operational. At the height of this, how many were not working?
Probably two-thirds.
Wow, that's a lot. Yeah. So is the holdup more of a lack of power to the pump stations or that the pump stations themselves were broken because of the storm?
It's a lack of power.
It's just the lack of power?
Yeah, and we are working closely with FPNL to get electric back to those particular stations. But like I said, we're using pumper trucks and generators right now to keep them going.
It's kind of an interesting intersection of electricity and water, correct?
Yep.
So you're working with Florida Power and Light, and they've set a deadline of September 22nd for everyone having power restored. And that's the will that be the day that the water pump stations are all back up and running?
I
mean, it's kind of a hard,
it's
hard to crystal ball it, but if it's a power thing, then by September 22nd, then if they have the power up, then those that can operate should be.
Absolutely.
All right. So people are still being asked, though, to keep their water use to a minimum. Is that in specific areas or neighborhoods?
In generally across the system, but it's getting better. That issue is getting a little bit better. We are still under a boil water notice. Hopefully we'll be able to lift that in a couple of days. We're just waiting on a lot of testing to come back that has to be done. One thing I want to talk to specifically customers of the Collier County Public Utilities Department, the Collier County Water Department, If you still don't have water at your house and you don't know why, we want you to call us and we will send somebody out to take a look and figure it out because everybody should have water now.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. Do you want people to also report if they're smelling sewage backups to you?
Yes, if you're smelling sewage backups, if you're within Collier County, dial 311 and report that to that number, 311. If you still don't have water at your house, I want you to call the water department directly at 239-252-6245. So, and we'll send someone out to take a look to figure out the situation.
So everybody in Collier County should have water running right now?
Everybody that's on the Collier County Public Utilities.
Yeah, good clarification there.
Yes,
and
that's
also on a boil order?
Yes, that is still on a boil water notice.
And that's and describe to me exactly how much you have to boil it. For a rolling boil for a minute?
The Florida Department of Health says bring it to a rolling boil for 1 minute. If you don't have power and you can't boil your water, you can also use just common household bleach, unscented bleach, and use maybe 8 drops in a gallon of water. Let it set for 30 minutes, and it would be good to use.
Okay. So I wanted to ask about if people are – you're not asking people to be as careful about how much water they use now?
We are still asking people to conserve water until we have all of the infrastructure back and all of the systems stabilized.
Okay, and then I wanted to ask also about businesses, particularly those that are, intense users of water like restaurants. And I saw a car wash operating 2 days ago. Does that add to the stress on the sewage systems, or are they on something separate?
The car washes generally recycle their water, so not all of it goes to the sewer system. But that is, as we have more businesses open up, They are on the same sanitary sewer system as the rest of the county. So we are seeing increased flows there because more businesses are opening up.
Yeah, more businesses are opening up. People are getting back to work, but then it kind of puts a little more stress on things. But things are getting better. I mean, you've got now only...
Things are getting better. Things are definitely getting better.
And there's only 140, you said, out of 800?
160.
Are those located in like one kind of area, or are those spread out?
It's pretty scattered.
Okay. We have a question from Scott in North Naples who asked, where and what neighborhoods are the pump stations not working in? Well, there's 160 of them, but like you just said, they're not really in any general area.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of spread throughout the county. I don't have a list or a map here right in front of me.
Okay, and then he asks, when will the boil water notice be lifted?
Hopefully within a couple of days.
Okay, so we're hoping within a couple of days because everybody has water now. And once it is lifted, do homeowners need to do anything to clean out their lines or anything like that?
Just let the water run for a couple of minutes just to flush any sediment that might have settled in their internal plumbing.
Okay. Do you want to run hot water or cold?
No, cold is fine.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us again, Margie Hapke with Collier County Public Utilities. I appreciate you letting us know. And can you give us that phone number one more time for people in Collier County who are customers of Collier County Public Utilities that may not have water running at this point?
That number is 239-252-6245.
Okay. And then if people want to report sewage backups that they're smelling in their neighborhood, that's, again, call 311.
Call 311.
All right. Thanks again, Margie.
Okay, thank you.
In some areas of Southwest Florida, Hurricane Irma's legacy is one of water with flooding and storm surge from the Mammoth Storm, which now a week later is leaving residents to deal with mud, flood damage, and mold. But those concerns are more than just a nightmare of property damage. The stormwater poses real health risks to those who have been exposed to it. This week, a 72-year-old man died after wading through floodwaters, and the storm surge that left a silty, muddy mess in communities like Everglades City has sent many people to the hospital for normally benign concerns like cuts and scrapes. According to the Naples Daily News, more than 100 Everglades City residents voluntarily got tetanus shots yesterday in hopes of preventing infections. Here to talk about the dangers posed by these floodwaters still standing in some communities and steps you can take to minimize your exposure to infection and other health concerns is Andrea McKinney with the Florida Department of Health. What are you telling people as far as what to be careful of when they're out there trying to do their cleanup?
Risk for wound infection following a storm can be raised during debris cleanup. And I know that a lot of citizens and responders are working around debris and floodwaters just to get things curbside. We're warning our community to be on the lookout for any infections associated with any wounds you might have that may have gotten in contact with floodwaters. We're also talking to our community about any foodborne disease, waterborne disease, mosquito bites. There's so many different health hazards that can happen after a storm.
Mm-hmm. Can I get into the specifics with you about infection? I mean, you get a cut from anything, especially, you know, like a jagged piece of metal or a tree limb or something that just scratches you. I mean, it's going to hurt. I mean, what level of hurt are we looking at? Is it like maybe 4 or 5 days later it starts looking really red, or does it turn red and angry fast?
Well, it depends. Any wound that you see that becomes hot to the touch or red or maybe has some pus behind it, you want to seek medical attention for. You never know what may have gotten into the wound, so you want to make sure you're getting it treated. But if you do get a cut, especially when cleaning debris from a yard, you want to make sure that you are washing it as soon as you can with soap, clean water and soap, and then covering it. And then seeking medical attention if it does become infected.
Which makes it seem kind of difficult to do, especially if you still don't have power and you don't have air conditioning. You're sitting there with a bandage on and you're sweating all over it. Does that create additional problems when people are still dealing with not having electricity?
You do want to try and keep a wound dry, but the most important thing is making sure you're keeping it as clean as possible. So as soon as you get a cut, try to stop what you're doing. Go inside. You don't want anything that may be on the debris that you're picking up or maybe something that's come from the ground to get into that wound. So cleaning it and just making sure it's covered so that debris can't get into the wound.
So stop what you're doing. Don't be a hero. You don't have to keep going through the cleanup. Just get that wound cleaned up before you go back out.
Exactly.
So I wanted to ask also about some of the debris that's out there. I mean, I know at least down in Everglades City, and you said you were just down there yesterday. When you go there and you see all that silt and stuff that was carried in by the ocean, is there anything that's carried in by those floodwaters that are of concern more so than just regular? We're also dealing with a raw sewage issue. Is there stuff that comes in from the ocean that people need to be worried about that may still be existing there in that dust and silt that's dried up?
Sure. Well, that dust and silt is probably contaminated. You know, it's saturated with the contaminated waters. It's either come or gone to or from the ocean. So like you said, there may be some sewage in that that's been saturated into the ground. And then you also have, if you're wading through some floodwaters, it may have come up from the Gulf. We do Vibrio is one of those things. It's a naturally occurring bacteria that is in our waters, and it's common when waters warm up. And we have very warm waters right now, and this is a time where we might see some Vibrio infections.
Do those look different from other kinds of infections, like a regular, normal, run-of-the-mill bacteria infection?
No, it's the same. It's the same as, you know, going into any type of floodwater. It usually would happen if you would have a cut on you and it enters your skin. Normal healthy people probably wouldn't have any effects from it. But if you're immune compromised or you have any underlying health conditions, it can make it a little bit worse. This is why, as soon as you see any redness or heat or swelling or pus around any open wound that you might have, that you seek medical attention immediately.
Is there anything that we need to worry about in the way of tetanus, too? Is that something people kind of forget about?
It might be. If it's been over 10 years since your last tetanus vaccination and you're out cleaning debris and you get a cut, we would recommend that you go in just to get that booster.
Mm-hmm. Now, those are fun to get. Everybody loves getting a tetanus shot.
Everyone loves shots.
Oh, yeah, those are great. And so you're saying that the best way to clean up a wound, initially, right when you first get it, is soap and clean water.
Yes, make sure the water's clean. And if you're in an area with a boil water, notice if you have a well water that may have been contaminated, use bottled water. And then just a little mild soap, household soap, and just clean it out. Make sure you get anything that may have gotten in there out of it. And then just cover it so nothing else can get in there.
Maybe I'm overkill, but I'm thinking, like, I'm pouring alcohol on stuff and hydrogen peroxide and everything I can get my hands on. Are those not a good idea?
No, you can do that as well. But basic soap and water, use what you've got. So if you've got just soap and water, use the soap and water on the wound. It's best to get it clean right away.
Those concerns for sewage and staying safe near water are just some of the obstacles facing thousands of Southwest Floridians today as recovery from the storm stretches into its second week. Nearly 100,000 homes are still without power, and tens of thousands of people are seeking shelter, food, water, and other necessities from local charities, food pantries, and other relief organizations. But the devastation from Irma was not equally distributed across Florida, and here to talk about what needs are being met and what's still lacking in our region are two guests working with those hardest hit by the storm. First, we have Major Dan Proctor, the regional coordinator with the Salvation Army in Naples. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks, Julie.
Also joining us today is Lori McFarland with the American Red Cross. Thank you for joining the show.
Well, thank you for having us.
First, Major Dan Proctor with the Salvation Army, you're based in Naples, and some areas of Collier County really bore the brunt of Hurricane Irma. What has the Salvation Army been able to do?
Well, we have been here since day one and before, actually preparing for this event. So we're feeding and hydrating folks, meeting basic needs. We also have a spiritual and emotional care component to our services. And so we've been out in all of those communities that are without the necessities such as power and running water.
Is there a geographic area where you're seeing the greatest need?
I think the first night, I think it was September 12th, we were in Everglades City, and most of our folks had evacuated north. So I was the designated driver of our mobile feeding kitchen, and we went down to Everglades City and just delivered a large amount of food down there. It was interesting. The place was devastated, but the cell phone tower was up and phones worked well down there for some reason. But they didn't work well in Naples at that time. But that was a that was an area, Goodland down in that area, so we were there from day one.
Yeah. And Lori McFarlane with the Red Cross, relief organizations have served tens and thousands of hot meals and handed out literal truckloads of food. Where can people go to get this now?
So right now we have about 4 to 5 shelters still open where people can come in. If they still don't have power, they can come here and stay in the shelters. We also have some mobile feeding kitchens as well that are preparing tens of thousands of meals. Every day we're sending out thousands of meals on our food trucks as well. So we're driving out to different communities that maybe people still don't have power. They don't have transportation to actually get out of their homes to get somewhere. Maybe they've run out of gas. So we're trying to take the food out to people, either in shelters or through our mobile feeding trucks.
Is it only meals or is it also canned non-perishable things that you're dropping off when you're out there?
Right now we're doing hot meals. We also have ready-to-eat meals, but the thing we're focusing right now on is that people get some hot meals. We're handing out bottles of water. We're finding that water and ice are what people are really needing because when they don't have power, you know, we can't give them anything perishable. So we're making sure they've got hot meals, ready-to-eat meals that don't need to be cooled before eating. That's what we're focusing on right now. We're also getting ready to start sending out relief supplies. So we're talking cleanup supplies, things people need like diapers and formula for their babies. We're getting geared up now to start taking those things out on those routes as well.
I've been hearing a lot about a need for diapers and baby products in Immokalee especially. And you're in Immokalee today, right, Lori?
That's right. I'm here in the Immokalee shelter that we've got open.
Okay, what are you seeing there?
So right now we've still got nearly 300 people staying here. Luckily, just today, a lot of power came on in the area. So we had several people who were able to finally go home, which is great. You know, as long as it's safe to go home, we want people to be able to get back to their normal lives as soon as possible. But we are still finding there's a huge need here. And the people here are really grateful that they've got an air-conditioned place to stay. They've got food coming to them 3 times a day. They've got water. They've got snacks. And the people here have just been fantastic.
So people are, you said you have about 300 people in the shelter, but today some of them are probably going to be able to go home. But what about people that don't have a home to go to? How long do these shelters stay open for them?
So we keep these shelters open as long as they're needed to be open. We have casework involved, so we're helping people figure out what their next steps are. So we're kind of beginning to wrap up the response phase, and we're moving into that recovery phase. So people who have a home, you know, we're helping them get their next steps planned. People who don't have a home, we're helping them too. You know, I was talking to someone in one of our shelters yesterday who she's trying to get, you know, a new tent for a family. The family, you know, was homeless to begin with. They lost their tent, and we're getting them a new, better tent. You know, we want to make sure that people are getting a plan. We don't want to send people out into the streets with no plan. We want to make sure that they've got somewhere to go.
Yeah, because most people's idea of disasters tend to be in other places, and you hear about things like FEMA trailers that are set up for people to go to when their homes have been destroyed. Do we see any of that on the horizon?
Well, we've had FEMA in here already through the shelter, and we're letting, you know, FEMA do their job. They're doing what they do. We're trying to help with what we're able to help with.
We are talking about disaster relief in Southwest Florida with the Red Cross and the Salvation Army. What needs are you seeing out there? Give us a call and share at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. One of the parts of Hurricane Irma response that some people may be surprised to see is a county like Collier County, where the very wealthy call Naples home. You see images of people living very close to the margins. And I wanted to ask you, Major Dan Proctor, when you see these victims of Irma, were there people living close to the edge?
I think so. A lot of folks, this is the strange thing about Collier County is that about 30,000 people every day commute into the city, into the county, because they cannot afford to live here. And, of course, they are helping provide basic services to the county. But, yes, I think that's what we saw was the folks that were on the edge and who were they were lacking already some of the basic necessities of life, and this made it even worse for them during this hurricane.
Well, the lack of affordable housing in Collier is almost legendary, I think. So, I mean, it's if you are working there and you're able to actually live there, it's not an easy thing to pull off. Some of the biggest issues that are faced right now is the people that had to take an extended time off of work, either because their workplace was closed or because their kids are out of school until Monday. And that's half a month's salary, and a lot of people can't handle that. Car payments don't change. Your bills remain the same. And you can't pay those bills with free meals and toiletries, and not to sound ungrateful for that. But is there anything from either the Salvation Army or the Red Cross to address those kinds of strains on household budgets? I want to ask first Major Dan Proctor with Salvation Army.
We're working with Community Foundation and other groups here in Collier County to meet some of those needs we're getting. We will be giving out at a certain point in the future gift cards that will help folks with that. We try to work with folks to meet their basic needs and to meet their ongoing commitments. We have our a social services department here that's here year-round, and we have some excellent folks that do that. They will be setting up a place where we can meet with them at in the future.
And Lori, with the Red Cross, are you hearing much about people being concerned about being able to pay the regular bills, like their car insurance and their car payment or mortgage or anything like that?
Absolutely, and very similar to the Salvation Army, you know, we are working with all different kinds of community partners, the county. We had a meeting last night where a group of community partners all came together to start discussing recovery plans, you know, everyone figuring out what each piece of the puzzle is and what everybody's going to do to help in that. You know, it takes a village. There's not one organization that's able to meet every single need, and so we're working with all the other organizations in the area, the county, FEMA, as you've already mentioned, and we're making sure that we're doing our part, and we're making sure these people have access to the resources that they need to make sure that all of those needs are met, whether it's met by the Red Cross or by Salvation Army or by whomever. We want to make sure they've got access to every possible resource.
Have you heard of anything from banks and credit cards or businesses that are offering relief from bills and debt in the wake of the storm? I've heard a few things, but I don't know if they're rumors. Lori?
You know, I couldn't speak to that. No, I haven't heard anything specifically from any specific corporations. I'm sure they are out there, but I couldn't tell you exactly who they were.
Okay. Well, I was just curious because I'd heard a couple things floating around. So, Lori, I wanted to ask you, your organization is offering what you call disaster mental health support. And we also heard Major Dan Proctor with the Salvation Army allude to that earlier. What is that?
So, you know, as you can imagine, this is a traumatic event for so many people. There's people who've you know, lost a little bit of their homes, and there's people who have lost everything. And as one of our disaster mental health workers mentioned yesterday, this isn't the only thing in people's lives. You know, some people have come in already with things happening in their lives, and this is just an added stressor. So we have privately trained professionals who come out and volunteer their time with the Red Cross. I mean, we've got people from all over the country coming down here to really help people with mental health issues, you know, counseling and talking through what's going on, helping them figure out what their next steps are. You know, this is kind of the first stage of casework is helping people with these, you know, this traumatic experience that they're going through. You know, being in the shelter here, I'm seeing it every day. You know, you'll start talking to somebody and they break down because this is a lot to handle for anybody, and particularly in some of these communities where, you know, they've started out with very little and they've lost even that. It's a lot to deal with. So one of our priorities is to make sure that we have licensed, trained people who are able to help get people through this first stage.
And the people that may have already had undiagnosed issues and then this kind of brought
Absolutely.
Things out to the fore. Have you seen any of that yourself? I mean, I don't want you to tell anybody's personal stories with their names.
Of course, no, of course. But I have seen that myself, yes. You know, I've been down here since last Thursday, and, you know, I see it a lot. There's people who, the moment you start talking to them, they break down. You know, they just can't. They can't make sense of this. You know, some people I've talked to were not homeless beforehand, but they are now. And it's something that we need to make sure that need is being met. You know, it's extremely important to meet the physical needs, the food, the shelter, but the mental health needs are just as important.
And Major Dan Proctor with the Salvation Army, you mentioned earlier that you're also working with some mental health. How is Salvation Army addressing that?
Well, we have emotional and spiritual care teams that come down here. These are trained ministers. They're also trained in disaster work as far as emotional and spiritual care is concerned. And so we put a little more spiritual context to meeting the needs of the folks. They may just need a hug. They may need to be to sit down and tell their story, that type of thing. But we have an incredible training program in the Salvation Army nationally that gets folks, our workers, ready for an occasion such as this. So we have a team of about 8 people right now in our emotional and spiritual care for Collier County that just go out. They go out with our mobile feeding kitchens and meet with the people there that may need some assistance right there on site. And so it's a great thing, and they might pray with them. They might just give them a cup of cold water. They might do some other things, but just meeting the needs at the point of need.
Do you find a difference in how kids adapt to these kind of things versus adults? I mean, what are you seeing out there, Dan?
Well, for instance, I was out in the Southwind Trailer Park the other day. The kids were just lined up with their families to get some food and some drinks and that type of thing from us, hot meals. I found them to be in pretty good spirits. Of course, one reason for that is they're out of school. But the other is that, I don't know, there was just kind of a spirit of camaraderie. I have a few little tricks that I show them. And so we had a good time with those kids out there. They seemed to be faring pretty well. This was a community that had nothing, no lights, no water. Not even, one lady said to me, we don't even have batteries for our flashlights. So now I think the power company is just about taking care of that now. But some pretty sad stories, but I found them to be, you know, lining up for their food, to be in pretty good spirit considering what was going on around them.
Yeah. And Lori, you're in Immokalee today. Have you seen kids? How have they been feeling? Have they been faring pretty well, or are they maybe hiding?
Yeah, you know, I would agree, actually. So, you know, the first day I was here, the Immokalee shelter had been open for several days before I got here. And the kids were running around. You know, at the beginning, I think it's kind of exciting. It's almost like a sleepover. But as the days have gone by, you know, the kids are asking when they're going home. So what we have done is, you know, in most of our shelters, we'll have a kids area that they can go in there. It's a safe place. There's toys. There's things to play with. There's crayons. We have like a system to make sure that each child is matched to a parent. So it's almost like a daycare. The parents check their kids in. The parents can then go take care of things they need to deal with, insurance or speaking to someone about medical issues. You know, they can kind of take a breather and deal with things that, you know, adults need to think about while their kids can go play. We had a clown come into one of our shelters the other day. He brought in some balloon animals, and the kids just thought that was a great, great experience. I think kids are resilient. They are, you know, probably processing things in their own way. And so we have, again, we have mental health opportunities for children. We work with the Church of the Brethren, and they come in and help the kids cope in a more childlike way than the adults are doing.
So Irma tore through other areas of the Atlantic before it hit Florida. And before that, we also saw a lot of damage in Texas from Hurricane Harvey. And I'm wondering, Lori, do you feel like you have enough boots on the ground, or are people kind of spread thin, or do you have enough to handle it?
I would say at this point, you know, we still have enough to handle it, but, you know, this is now going on, you know, 3 weeks, I suppose, if you count everything that happened in Harvey, and even a little bit before that, because we had people stationed before Harvey even hit. So, you know, we are always looking for volunteers, and at the moment, we are training new volunteers at a record pace. We are particularly in this area here in Immokalee and you know, the Collier County, Lee County area, we are calling for bilingual volunteers because we need people who are able to translate and speak to the people who are staying. We want to reflect the community that we're serving. So right now we are really pushing for new volunteers, not just across Florida, but across the entire country, because we don't want to wear out the volunteers that have been spending 3 weeks here and there trying to serve the people who have been affected by these two hurricanes. So while I would say that, yes, the needs are being met right now, the need for volunteers is constant, and in a way it's urgent.
What kind of time commitment are you looking for with volunteers?
So for some people, it may be a matter of, you know, they can give a week, or maybe they can give their daytime, their evenings. We would love for people who are able to maybe come work in a shelter in which they would stay in the shelter for maybe a week or two at a time. Not everybody is able to give that, especially if you've got to go back to work or if you've got to go back to school. But people who are able to give any amount of time, whether it be in a shelter, whether it be driving a truck into a new neighborhood that needs food, sometimes it's just a matter of we need someone to help us, you know, with some logistics, that kind of thing.
It's nice to have a local that would know the roads, right?
Absolutely. That would be fantastic. So mm-hmm. really, we'll take the time commitment that people are able to offer.
How do people get in touch to do that? Do they need to go to your website to register themselves, or how does that work?
Yep, the easiest way is to go to redcross.org and sign up there. And because, you know, we're in full-on training mode, people will be contacted pretty quickly by our local chapter. And the trainings are happening kind of every few days to make sure that we've got kind of a just-in-time opportunity for anybody.
Exactly. And so
redcross.org.
Redcross.org. I have a link to that on our website, wgcunews.org, too, in case you didn't have time to write that down. You can always reference that later. And Major Dan Proctor with the Salvation Army, I wanted to ask you, are you in need of volunteers also?
Absolutely. We have about 60 employees with the Salvation Army here in Collier County, with offices here in Naples and in Immokalee, and we are on the ground there 365 days a year in both places. We have folks that speak Spanish, that speak Creole, so we already had some folks in place. Some of our employees who can't work with us right now at our family stores will serve as translators during this, but we also are taking volunteers, and our website's a little bit longer, www.disaster.salvationarmyusa.org, and fill out the little information there. I'll get it, and we'll get you lined up to volunteer with us at our main location here in Naples.
And you get people to work. And then I wanted to ask both of you also, and I'll start with Major Dan Proctor, about donations. What kind of things are you looking for people to donate? I know cash is king, and people really do need a lot of money to get things going, but do you want people to send just money, or are you looking for certain material good items?
At this point, we are looking for cash. That is what you're right. Cash is king. I've been around doing this for 39 years. I've seen a second disaster created by things that have been sent to the bottom of Florida. I was here during Hurricane Andrew also. But you create a second disaster when so many things come into the area without checking with Red Cross, Salvation Army, or some other organization before you send in-kind goods down here. So the best thing anybody can do right now is cash. We have corporate connections sometimes if we need a lot of water or a lot of certain items that we have companies that will send that right into and ship it right into
it. You can
but
probably stretch that dollar a little bit further.
Cash. Yep.
Yeah.
We can get exactly what we need with that dollar.
Is that kind of the same story at the Red Cross?
Absolutely. I completely concur with everything he said. You know, cash is the fastest and most efficient way because that way we can spend it as needed exactly when we need it and where. I like the way he put that as a second disaster when you have all of these well-meaning donations. You know, of course, we appreciate the generosity of people, especially during disaster time, but certainly the most efficient way is cash or online, you know, financial donation.
Yeah, people seem to want to show that they care so much by going out and buying that teddy bear, but then you have a truckload of teddy bears getting in the way of things that you really do need, you know?
Exactly.
All right. So can you give me one more time your website, both of you? I'll ask Lori first. The website for people that want to go and volunteer or donate, where do they go?
I can go to redcross.org, or, you know, if you want to donate, say, $10 to the Irma hurricane relief, you can dial or you can text Irma to 90999.
Okay. And then Major Dan Proctor, one more time, could you just, I know it was a little bit of a longer email address, but people may have had a moment to get their pen out. Could you give us that one more time?
Sorry about that. We're a little bureaucratic here.
No, that's okay.
www.disaster.salvationarmyusa.org. To donate, call 1-800-SAL-ARMY.
Sal Army. Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank our guest, Major Dan Proctor with the Salvation Army in Naples. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank Lori McFarlane with the American Red Cross. Thanks so much for all the work you're doing.
Thank you for your interest in the people here, or the area who need help.
All right. Well, coming up, if there is any evidence needed of the power of this storm, a drive down any street, put on a display of downed trees, big and small. Next, we'll talk with a certified arborist about the trees that fared well and those that did not, and what you may be able to salvage in the aftermath. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. It's sad to see the number of trees that were tossed about in the hurricane winds or snapped in half by the many tornadoes that are suspected of also twisting pool cages here and there. Most striking are the oak trees whose shallow root system lifted out of the ground as the tree fell over, looking like a doily that the tree happened to be sitting on. Near Fifth Avenue in Naples, a park bench that was sitting on one of those root complexes was lifted off the ground and is now about 10 feet off the ground at an impossible angle for sitting. Joining us to talk about all your tree-related questions in the wake of Hurricane Irma is ISA-certified arborist Ian Orlikoff with Signature Tree Care in Naples. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Unfortunately, under these circumstances.
Yeah, I know. I bet this just breaks your heart as a tree guy.
It does. We've been working on, you know, particular trees for many, many years, trying to get them just right, and now it's like starting over from scratch in many cases. So it is very disheartening.
It's sad to see them. We are talking about the trees that were down by this hurricane with a certified arborist. And if you have a tree-related question, you can join the conversations, too, at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Ian, you know, we're seeing a lot of downed trees in the wake of this storm. And as an arborist, your worst nightmares kind of come true here. You say you've been really busy in the last few weeks since the storm. What kind of calls are you getting for the most part?
Well, it kind of goes in stages. Initially, it's the tree on the house and holes in the roofs. And then it's starting to transition into more of the, you know, trees leaning up against the house that aren't quite as emergent and in the backyards. So first and foremost, it was, you know, any roofs that were damaged and trees that were in the way of access for emergency personnel and whatnot that we had to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it'll turn into more of the reconstructive pruning phase, and then also the stump removals. So there's a period where it's very chaotic, and it's just the emergency work at first. And it starts to wane off a little bit, and people begin to rebuild their landscape back slowly but surely.
What are some of the reasons that we saw so many downed trees? Is it because of the strength of the storm or the flimsiness of the trees?
Well, it's a combination of many factors. It's, you know, with these wind gusts and the eye wall that came across, we certainly saw the most damage from that. But it is probably within the urban environment. The biggest factor is the soil is poor soil because we have compacted soils for building pads, mm-hmm. and then trees are placed in that type of soil, so the root structure doesn't really have the best environment to grow in. And so it's oftentimes a very shallow root plate because of the compacted soils the roots don't like, so they'll stay closer to the surface. And so that's typically in the urban environment why we see a lot of trees tipping over.
Is that why they were all, it seems like every tree in a median fell over?
They did, and that's exactly why, because in the medians, when they're constructing the road, they have the crushed lime rock for the base of the road. And then they'll put the curbs in and come in with maybe a foot of topsoil or so.
Mm-hmm.
So the root zones don't really have anywhere to go except in the top, you know, 6 inches. And they're only having a 10-foot wide area to place their roots. And so they just tip over like dominoes.
Were you surprised to see some of those root systems just kind of up at an angle, sticking straight out from trees, just lifted out of the ground like that? Had you ever seen anything like that before?
I have, and I've lived in North Carolina, and we had several hurricanes up there that I've been through, and moved down here in 2000 and been through several hurricanes here, so unfortunately seems like they're following me around. So it's something that I've seen many times over.
I'd never seen it before, so I was kind of surprised to see those shallow roots. Do they just look like lace, you know? We have a call coming in from Kevin in North Naples. Kevin, what would you like to ask?
I have two queen palms that were blown completely down, and they're just sitting there. It's been 8 days. If I have them put back up, will they reestablish? Will they continue to grow?
That's a good question. There are a lot of palm trees out there that are kind of leaning over or completely fallen over. Can they be replanted and propped back up?
In most cases, they can. If the root ball is intact and hasn't pulled the sandy soil completely out of the root ball, they can be straightened, and it's important to keep them watered until they can be straightened, because right now, just as if we're stressed out, we need water. So the plants need water as well in that type of environment. And so they can be straightened up and braced properly, and then they'll regenerate some new roots to establish themselves once again. Now, there are certain palms that are very temperamental, such as the Bismarckia and Canary palms. Once they lean over like that, that type of disruption to their root system, is they're not going to really be able to handle the shock very well.
But a
queen palm is pretty resilient.
The queen palms are. But how about royal palms? I saw one that was huge. I mean, it was really big, and it was completely leaning over and sort of threatening a house. Can those be righted again?
They sure can. They're easily transplanted with large equipment being installed in landscapes. So basically, if they've leaned over and their root system is still intact, they can, in a sense, be replanted or transplanted, so to speak.
And then I wanted to ask, still on the palm subject, we talked a while back about getting your trees ready for hurricane season, and you said that you don't want to trim back too much of your palm fronds because you don't want that, I think it was, did you call it the heart of the palm?
Correct. Right.
You don't want that to be too exposed. What if you have a palm tree and it still has palm fronds on it, but those new little shoots coming out of the middle, the top, they're a little bit yellowish looking, what if those have snapped off? Is that a big deal, or is that the heart that broke off?
Well, the heart is the round, like the bulb-looking part of the plant. And the new shoots that are coming out are being generated from within the heart. So the tip of the shoot, it seems like it's been bent, should continue to push out and may be disfigured for the rest of its time, and eventually will become part of the lower portion of the canopy and then be shed, and new shoots will generate.
Okay, so people shouldn't really so much worry about those that much. I think we have another palm question again from Stephen in Cape Coral. Stephen, what would you like to ask?
Hi, I'd like to ask your guest. I returned from evacuation and I had a palm tree, a royal palm tree. It was leaning over on the roof of my garage and was there for a couple of days, and I decided to prop it back up. We hooked a tow truck up to it. Put it back in place. You know, we dug up the soil and the sod around it. Just put it back. It fell right back into place. We put everything back together again. I've got it braced in four positions, and I've been watering it every day now for about 4 days. But I just took a look at it, and it doesn't look that healthy. So I'm wondering what the prospect is for its survival.
Okay. Well, there's probably going to be a certain amount of shock. And, it's a living organism, so you're always kind of taking a gamble. Royal palms are very expensive trees, and they add a lot to your landscape, so the gamble may be worth it to you to make the effort to prop it back up. However, if it is looking like it's starting to wilt, it can go through a period of shock, and it may push out of that, or it may just continue to decline, at which point, if it declines to the amount where the crown is starting to all lean over, then that means the bud is collapsing, and at that point you want to have it removed because it's a hazard.
Is it possible to overwater that royal palm?
I know it would be very expensive to replace, and I would sure like to see it survive.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm going to nurture it.
Water's the best thing.
And keep watering it, and can you do too much watering?
You don't want it saturated to where it's sopping wet 24/7. You want to allow it to drain a little bit and the soil be moist somewhat, and then water it before it dries out.
And then we had another question that came in from Punta Gorda, and he says he had a plumeria tree, and one limb where the branches grow out was ripped off during the storm. Otherwise, the tree appears fine. What should he do about the gash on that tree? Should he paint it, wrap it, leave it alone, or something else? What do you do with exposed parts of a tree where it's broken?
Well, they don't recommend painting it. That's a older practice that was very common, and they found out after the many years of research that it actually traps moisture in. And so that's a myth that it helps. So don't do anything to it. I would probably sand it. If you have the ability to get a rough grit sandpaper and sand those rough edges down, it'll allow it to heal over a little bit easier and faster. Fortunately, those are very resilient plants. You can cut them into 50 different pieces, stick them in the ground, and they'll continue to grow.
I know. They've been called the friendship tree because you just hack off a branch and stick it in the ground and walk away, and you're good to go. And you can share it with people.
Absolutely.
I love that tree that way. And we have another call from Jack in Fort Myers. Jack, what would you like to ask about?
Yes. I was calling because one of the most devastating tree losses I've witnessed down here in Fort Myers was at the Edison home in the Ford Estates. There's a very, very big old banyan tree. I think it's a banyan tree. And my question is that tree done for? Do they have to saw it up and get rid of it? Or is there any way they can, like, get a crane and straighten it up? Because that's a really old tree, big part of our history.
Did it actually tip over?
It did. It completely tipped over, and all the roots are exposed.
Okay. Well, they can be righted. That's a very large tree to right. I've righted trees in the past, but that is definitely probably one of the biggest banyans that I've seen. They're very resilient trees, and so if it's righted in a short period of time, it should have a good chance of survival because they are very tough trees. You can cut them way back, and they will continue to sprout out, which isn't the best pruning practice, but however, they can take that type of stress. So watering the roots, whatever you can do to keep it moist is very important.
And that's an interesting topic that you bring up, is whether or not to right a tree. I noticed on your blog that you indicated there are a lot of tree removal people that will come in and say, oh, that looks no good, you need to just remove it. Do you want to warn people off of just blanket removal of all trees? Because there are some that can make it.
Yes, I think we're kind of at a phase now where everybody is extremely fearful of trees. And had it not been for the trees, there would be more structural wind damage to buildings, because the trees are actually what buffer the wind from the house. So, yes, there is going to be some damage to houses from trees, but the amount of damage that they prevent is enormous. So removing trees is kind of very common right after a hurricane because people are very fearful. Lots of people come into town and they recommend, oh, you got to take this one down. So they're taking down trees that are still viable trees that haven't suffered any damage, and they're trying to get more work out of it, I guess. And that is the exact opposite of what we should be doing. There are several trees that can be righted and safely done. And there are many different methods that we can do to take care of trees after the storm, such as reconstructive pruning, and just making sure that the root zones are healthy. If they've lifted a little bit from heaving, is what they call, there'll be some gaps in the root zone, and that can be filled back in with sand and just watering it in as you were replanting a tree. And oftentimes the roots will just regenerate and grow even better to stabilize the tree.
And
trees will compensate.
What about trees that are still standing in water, but they seem to be doing okay? I've got one of those powder puff ones in the backyard. It's sitting in water, and it's been there for 2 weeks in nothing but water, but still blooming. Is that a last gasp for trying to look good before it dies, or can some of these trees handle it?
That's a good point that you made. Sometimes trees will flower out or send more fruit out because that's the last bit of energy, and they want to get as much genetic material out there as possible. Some trees can handle standing water and some can't, because in standing water you'll get anaerobic conditions, which starts to introduce diseases and whatnot into the root system. So it's just going to be a wait and see. There's a lot of learning going on after a storm in trees.
Well, especially for people that aren't from here. And then I wanted to ask also about suggestions for replacing trees. Are some of the trees that went down, did they go down because they're non-native, and did native trees fare this type of weather better?
Well, there are certain trees that are known to be strong trees. Well, just very commonly is the live oak, but there's a lot of live oaks that went over. I think more importantly is the site conditions that we plant them in the soils that we put them in, the nursery stock, the quality of the plant that we put in the ground. There are many other factors in the urban environment that predispose the trees to fail. In case if you see trees that are standing in groups, there's always strength in numbers. The trees that are standing alone, particularly like in the little parking lot finger islands, they're down everywhere you look because they have no root zone. So if you can plant trees in groupings, if you have the opportunity, that's always the best case scenario. And also good tilled, well-tilled soil, and not the soil that we have crushed lime rock.
Mm-hmm.
So the site conditions and when we're planting, where we plant them, is very important. There are several trees that are considered very strong trees, but again, they, you know, with a 150-mile-an-hour, 140-mile-an-hour gusts, they're going to go over.
Yeah, there's no real fighting against that. Well, I know you're incredibly busy, so I'm going to let you go, but thanks for taking a break and talking with us today.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
All right.
And can I make one more note?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Be very safe out there because there's a lot of people. It's very hot. It's a very extreme environment that they're in, and there's a lot of injuries. In fact, a client of mine was on a ladder and crushed his pelvis. He's in the hospital.
Yeah, so be careful trying to do it yourself.
Think safety.
All right.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Ian Orlikoff, ISA-certified arborist with Signature Tree Care in Naples. Thanks so much. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin-Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.